ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming is expanding to weekdays.
We did try to stay weekly. The news said no. So 5 days a week it is.
It's serious reporting on global events. Plus you're invited for a daily radio coffee table chat with me, Geraldine Doogue.
And with me, Hamish McDonald. And in 2026, Latika Burke and Kylie Morris.
Together we'll explore the global forces reshaping our world in mostly calm conversation.
Calm, Geraldine. Global roaming. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine losing the one person who never judged you. Now imagine the person was your pet. Hi, I'm James Carlton. Welcome to God Forbid on ABC Radio National, the panel show about the things we believe. And our culture, our religions too, can make us believe that human loss is different to animals dying. But tell that to someone who believes one of their most important relationships in their life is with their pet. We've got a wonderful God Forbid panel to explore this. Millie Cordaro is Professor of Psychology at Texas State University. She's with us from Austin. In our Brisbane studio, Dr. Daniela Rizzo is a theologian at Alpha Crucis College. And David Mikey is known around the world for his novels and nonfiction books on Buddhism and animals. Can I start by welcoming each of you warmly and asking, what's your experience of animal love and loss? David, you first.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me, James. Apart from writing about animals, I've always been an animal lover from a very young age. In fact, I wanted to be a vet until I was about 16. I grew up in Zimbabwe. So we not only had dogs and cats, but I spent my holidays taking care of elephant calves and rhinoceroses and giraffes and what have you. So I've always been exposed to a wide range of animals. In my adult life, we've had a number of cats and dogs. So I feel very, very close to animals. And I always have had a very special bond with animals.
And animal loss, David?
Yeah, well, sadly, we have had to say goodbye to 4 cats during the course of the last 10 years, partly because we tend to go and adopt the most unadoptable cats in the cat havens, who tend to be older ones. And certainly, you know, I'm all too acquainted with having to say goodbye to a loved one.
To you, Daniela, what's your story?
I think one of the most impactful moments in my life, it was one of those, you know, light bulb moments was, I've always been an animal lover. I've had pets. However, I really saw the distinction between having a pet and having a companion animal, and having a relationship that is so reciprocated. And I can share to a story where my father had passed away. I was really not dealing with it very well, the whole grief thing. I was finding it really difficult one evening that I couldn't wipe away the tears, you know, quickly enough. It was just pouring from me. And I remember crying out to God, and I said, God, you know, right now, I really need a tangible experience of your love. How is there a way that you could comfort me where I actually felt you physically in this moment? And at that very moment, without a lie, I had my cat, his name's Al Pacino, my cat jumped into my arms and embraced me in that moment. And I felt God's love in that moment through the action of my co-creature, my companion animal. And it was from that moment that I started not looking at my cat Pacino as a pet, but started to look at him as a companion animal and realize that our lives are so intertwined and we rely on each other emotionally that I could never be his superior and he could never be my subordinate. So when talking about loss of an animal or a companion animal, I think to Pacino, who thankfully is very much still alive. But, you know, when it comes to that day that I would need to say goodbye, I think it would be just absolutely heart-wrenching, as it was for all of my animals that I've had in my life, but particularly this very special relationship that I have with Pacino. It's really taught me so much.
And Millie, in Austin, Texas, what can you tell us?
Yes. Well, first off, thank you so much for having me and Daniela. That's such a beautiful story to hear about your companion animal. And like Daniela and David, I've also always been a lover of animals, and I went through my own loss of a beloved pet. And I'm also a psychologist. The human in me, though, was so shocked by my own bereavement, my own suffering. And I recall at the time thinking about euphemisms around heartbreak and loss, like the euphemism of feeling heavy-hearted or feeling gutted and turned inside out. It was remarkable about how true those euphemisms were in light of it being a pet. And I was really raw, but I knew that when I could get to a point that I wanted to somehow act on it in the spirit of helping others. But I remember just feeling really brokenhearted and also just broken open from it.
David, these stories we've heard, yours included, are real and relatable. So why does the idea of likening a pet loss to a human loss remain unsettling, if I can put it that way?
Gosh, well, James, I personally don't find it unsettling. I think it's completely understandable. I know that there are people out there in the world who maybe have a different view of animals that find it that way. And then for those people, I think there's a dissonance because they see animals as inferior, subordinate, discardable. But for those of us who have a different view of animals, I think it makes complete sense. I mean, many people, especially older people who have lost their lifelong partner, for example, or live alone, they're not living alone in the sense that they have another sentient being in their life. Because in Buddhism, we use the word sentient being or semchen, mind haver. And all mind havers are similar in three important respects. We all wish for happiness, we all wish to avoid suffering, and we all value our lives above all else. And so we see a commonality between humans and animals that's part of our tradition. And therefore, I personally think it's entirely understandable that somebody would feel equally bereft losing their cat as they may feel losing their husband, which may sound kind of bizarre, but I don't really see a difference in the sense of the mind of the perceiver, which is the most important thing. The person who's experiencing it, it's their mind that matters, really. And some people's minds, their relationship they have with their pets or their animal is equally intense as it could be with a human being.
And Millie, it's interesting what David says. I guess there are some people who see animals in the abstract as subordinate or different or species with whom one can't have a fully real relationship. Mm-hmm. But for their own pet, they may obviously feel differently by virtue of the lived experience, and they can live with the cognitive dissonance of that.
It is quite fascinating, isn't it? And I think that it speaks in part to the attachment or the quality of the bond, the emotional bond that we have with a companion animal, that we have with human companions. And, you know, whether or not that's a deep bond or more surface level is absolutely going to affect the type of grief, if at all, that we feel. And I feel that that's for both humans and non-humans alike.
Daniela, what do you think about these intersecting worlds between the personal relationship with animals, the abstract concept of the animal?
You know, that's a great question. I think grief hurts because, I mean, love has been invested. The pain is proportionate to the relationship, not the species category. I don't see Christian theology treat grief as misplaced simply because the one that's lost is non-human. I think that grief is a sign that a relationship of care and responsibility was real and meaningful. So I don't think we could, you know, really discard animals from that definition. I think the experience of grief is just because it's misplaced love.
And yet, Daniela, that story you shared about Pacino sitting on your lap at the exact moment you cried to God for help, mourning your father, you say that was more than companionship. It was even communion, which is a very powerful, you know, concept. I mean, I guess there are some Christians who would think that's sacrilegious. There are some atheists who think that's superstitious. Are you happy with that outcome?
Well, I think that we need to open ourselves up more to the mystery of the Spirit. I think that's where, you know, Christians who are very much traditional in their approach to how they practice their faith need to open up themselves to the mystery of the Spirit. And I think the mystery of the Spirit can be also found in the non-human world. I mean, it's alive with living, breathing, sentient creatures that share in their own experience of a creator God. Now, whether they can articulate that experience is another question, but they are born and enlivened from God's creative act. So for them not to be able to share in something like communion is, you know, really quite restrictive in terms of how we imagine the Spirit and to work and breathe and move across the world.
And yet, formal Christian teaching says animals can't, quote-unquote, receive communion.
I think we need to look at creation as an act of communion in the sense that we aren't removed from creation as humans, that we're embedded in it, and that is a communion of relationship there. And when we think about Christ coming to the world and being in communion with other animals in when he was born, you know, we think about Christ walking through the wilderness after his baptism and communing with other non-human creatures, wild creatures. We think about Christ riding on a donkey on Palm Sunday and being greeted in Jerusalem. There are so many examples of Christ communing with other creatures. And I think if we're thinking a little bit more open to that idea, we can see animals appear in ways that might be mysterious, but also interesting in the way that, you know, what does that teach us in our own relationships with non-human creatures?
On ABC Radio National, this is God Forbid. We are talking about pets and the grief that they cause us when we lose them. We are with Professor Millie Cordaro, we are with Dr. Daniela Rizzo, and we're with David Mickey. And David, you've written that science is beginning to reveal what pet owners have kind of always known, which is that animals can be compassionate and mindful. Not always, but aren't we all trying?
Yes. Well, I'm always astonished by the number of things you see scientists, experimental researchers research, just to point out what we see as glaringly obvious. You know, that dogs can show affection or cats can be standoffish or whatever.
What about when they claim credit for the discovery? Do you does your Buddhist love extend there?
Well, we're also told to practice compassion, so that's where that kicks in, and equanimity. No, I just find it amusing, to be honest. But no, what I do find it fascinating that we now are living in a time where there's sophisticated enough technology to be able to measure stuff that was previously unmeasurable. And what this is doing is revealing all different levels of the workings of animals' minds and their behavior. And there's a fellow called Rupert Sheldrake, I'm sure you've come across him, who wrote a book called Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home. And they put up video cameras in people's houses, and they showed that a dog would typically get out of one part of the house and move to the front door just before the owner arrived home, or some time before. And then they decided, well, let's game the system. Let's get the person to come home at different times of the day, unexpectedly. And they would then see what the dog did. And they find that the dog would actually get up and move at the time that the owner had been told by message, because he's taking part in the experiment, it's time to go home. So there is a kind of element of telepathy, if you like, in the part of animals are able to pick up or tune into what their people are doing. when I say animals, I'm obviously talking about some specific cases, because it's hard to define what cats may or may not think. Although, interestingly, when Daniela was telling a wonderful story about Pacino, I had very much the same experience once, where I was sitting on the side of the sofa feeling very upset about a phone call, and instantly my little Nala, my beautiful little ginger cat, just hopped up beside me. And I have no doubt that Nala was picking up on my grief. They can be very, very attuned. I mean, when you think about it, the big problem that we have with pets is they can't speak English, generally. But they can speak very, very powerfully. They can communicate very, very powerfully in a nonverbal way. And they're the experts in nonverbal communication. And to me, the closest the better we are at being able to speak their language by being nonverbal with them, the more powerful our bond. So when we're able to quieten our minds to some extent and be with our pet, it's amazing what we can actually pick up, because most of our communication with them is one way, it's us to them. But on rare occasions when we're quiet, we can actually get onto the same page as them, in a sense, and identify more about what they're doing. And experiments like that, dogs that know when their people are coming home, and other experiments like that are revealing levels of tuning in this that we didn't previously know. And I don't want to monopolize too much, but there's another fascinating research done on an African grey parrot. And why they are fascinating is because they're the best speakers in the world. And it's been shown that not only do they just imitate things, they actually know what they're saying. They can, if you have red square and there's a red square shape, the parrot can tick it with his beak or pick up a red square-shaped object or yellow round or green triangle. So there is evidence that animals not only, there's evidence that they certainly can identify and communicate when they're able to speak English, but of course only parrots can. But all the other animals and the pets, especially cats and dogs that we know so well, of course they can communicate. We just need to get better at speaking their nonverbal language.
David, we heard Daniela talking about the communication she had with her cat when it sat on her lap in a moment of grief about her father. She took it as a communication mediated by the Holy Spirit. What is the mediating force for you? And does it matter if it's different?
No, to me, that's one of these unknowable things. I mean, we don't know what was going through the mind of Pacino, nor do we know what was going through the mind of Nala, my little ginger cat. All we know is that they were responding to something. They were clearly, to me, it was an empathetic moment. I felt that Nala was recognizing my emotion and seeking to comfort me. That's all that I can only report on what I was thinking. I can't speculate on what was going through her mind. But what I think it does show very clearly is the level of emotional intimacy that we have with our pets.
And Millie, what do you think about different belief systems shaping our relationship with animals? Is it kind of different paths to the same destination?
I do think that there are different cultural distinctions that can influence how we think about animals in general and pets. I'm very fortunate, and I'm very biased, but I live in a city that is very pet-friendly and very dog-centered. And I have a beautiful cross-section of friends. Some are married, some are single, some have human children, and some don't. Yet they all share this common denominator of having a pet that's their child. Some of my friends plan their days out based on where they can take their dogs. And then in other parts of the world, and, you know, there's going to be a completely different frame of reference for how people think and interact with their animals. So I definitely think it runs the gamut.
This proves, Millie, that culture shapes our relationship, our responses to animals. Obviously, it therefore shapes our response to animal or pet death. Tell me about your work in what is called disenfranchised grief.
Yeah, so when I was going through my own lived experience of mourning the death of a pet, I was getting some interesting comments at the time that were invalidating. People were saying things like, it's just an animal and you'll get over it soon, or it's been 2 weeks, why are you still so upset?
Get a new one.
Get a new animal. Just get a new animal. I'm sure there's more that people have heard of. And I really found it fascinating as a psychologist that it complicates the grief in such a way where not only does a person feel invalidated, but they might also participate in their own undermining of the experience of mourning a loss. And so for the listeners, disenfranchised grief, it's a type of undervalued grief in a society where that grief is, it's not socially endorsed, it's not acknowledged, and for many people, they are left to suffer either quietly or silently around the loss of a beloved pet. So my little part to try and tease apart pet loss, give it a voice, validate whoever I could. And I started, and my work started with trying to acknowledge this just within the counseling profession itself, that this is something that other psychologists and therapists should be looking out for.
I love the concept of disenfranchised grief. I think it's a wonderful summary. And my own personal experience of that is very, very frequently when our cats have died, the one word that people often use is that, when are you going to replace her? When are you going to replace your cat? I think, well, it's an absurd concept. You can't replace, you know, it's almost like, do people ever say when somebody's husband has died, when are you going to replace him?
Right.
It would be considered outrageous. You know, you can't replace a person, or you can't replace your beloved cat either. So I really just think that's a great summary of it, Millie.
Absolutely. And I wanted to add one more piece as I'm thinking about it, is with the disenfranchised grief, it's the invalidation isn't just coming externally. I think that, you know, based on cultural conditioning, that some people begin to feel humiliated and ashamed of their own grief for the way that they're feeling due to that loss. And so there's another piece of that disenfranchised grief to be aware of that we need to continue to acknowledge as well.
And can that cultural self-censorship, I'm being an idiot to feel this way about my grief, I'm being too emotional by having to pull over the car and burst into tears, you know, X months or even years after the event, you then self-censor your own grief and thereby harm the very process itself.
Absolutely. In some cases, that can lead to what's called complicated grief, where we don't allow ourselves to go through the process of mourning and suffering in a genuine, fully expressed way, which could make it even harder to get through, to get past, to create a new life, a new reality.
Daniela, tell me about this in religious spaces. Are some more mindful than others about the place of animal grief?
I think there's a real hunger to talk about animal grief within the Christian tradition. The question that I often get when in discussion with just people of all walks of life, hey, is my companion animal going to go to heaven? Am I going to see them in heaven? Because I can't imagine a God that would allow me to enter heaven but wouldn't allow my cat or my dog to enter heaven. And so this is a question on people's minds because they don't want to live apart too long from their companion animal who they've just lost. They think that, well, there's a hope, isn't there, that, okay, I'm saying goodbye to them now, but I'm going to see them again. And it is a question that is a serious question. it's not in jest, you know, because I write a lot about animals and theology. And so when people discover that, that is the very first question that comes to their lips. And so it's encouraging because it shows me that people love and care for their animals and that it is worthy of theological discussion because there is so much love placed in these relationships, and rightly so.
And David, it may be comforting to know you'll be reunited with a pet in heaven, or in the case of bad dogs, in hell. What does Buddhism teach here?
Like Christianity and other great spiritual traditions, the Buddhist view is that there is something of us that continues, and that something that continues applies to all sentient beings. So all beings with consciousness, their very subtle consciousness will continue after this lifetime, just as ours does. You might liken that subtle consciousness to like a thread that goes through a necklace, and every bead represents a different life. So it doesn't come to a sudden end. That's the kind of Eastern view. What is interesting is that Buddhism makes a differentiation between attachment and love. And this can be very, very helpful for helping us with grief. Attachment is when we are missing something, we are grieving something, we'll feel an intense sense of loss because that being is no longer with us, whether that's a human or a pet. But love is defined very specifically as the wish to give happiness to others. And so when we have a loved pet, we wish very much for their happiness. So this gives rise to a kind of dichotomy, if you like, and we all experience it in relation to all people who die, whether they're human or animal, is that if somebody has been ill for a long time and they just want a release, you know, it will be a blessing for them to go. They want to go and we can't bear to see them in pain. Part of us really, really wishes that they could just be free from their pain and suffering and be at peace. That's the part that loves them, that wants their happiness. The part that it causes us to be unhappy is the loss, the terrible wrench that we feel no longer having them. That's the attachment. And so in Buddhism, we are taught to really focus very, very, as much as possible on love. And because we believe that our pet will continue, we are offered a whole lot of practices that we can do, especially for the next 7-week period after they die, which is a period during which a being passes through a transition stage. Most people will know the word bardo. And in that time, we have the potential to influence what happens to them next. Because as a subtle being of thought, they have the capacity to tune into us and to actually be with us. They're almost like telepathic in the same way that they were before. And by doing positive, virtuous things on their behalf and acknowledging their presence, we have the capacity to help them through that time of transition. And so what is wonderful about that, whether or not one believes in it or not, is it gives us a very practical period of 7 weeks after the death of a being during which we will keep them front and center in our thoughts during the day. But instead of having this dreadful sense of loss and grief the whole time, we have another set of things to focus on, which is, how can I help Nala at this time? Because only I can help her because I've got a very, very strong connection to her. She's not going to go elsewhere. She'll be coming back here. And I can do things for her that'll help her. And so that sense of agency is all important because it helps us through the grief. And I feel this is a very practical and useful offering that Buddhists have.
On ABC Radio National, this is God Forbid. We are talking about pets and the grief that they cause us when we lose them, grief, the price of love. We are with Professor Millie Cordaro, we are with Dr. Daniela Rizzo, and we're with David Mickey. Christianity generally teaches that because God created people in his image, only he has the power to give life and take it away. Animals are not made in the image of God. Therefore, euthanizing a sick pet is not a sin like it is with people, according to some interpretations of Christian teaching. It's in fact an act of Christian mercy. Daniela, tell me about this and your attitudes to it.
That's a great question. I was really hoping you would get to the concept of the image of God. And from a theological Christian perspective, if we're called to live as bearers of the Imago Dei or the image of God, and even more to reflect the Imago Christi, which is the image of Christ, then our posture towards others is defined by self-giving love and protection of the vulnerable. And when I see Christ's pattern, it's not domination, but it's servanthood. And it's a movement away from power seeking and more towards care. Within that frame, love is not restricted only to humans. It's expressed towards any vulnerable creature placed within our sphere of responsibility. So humans aren't entitled as a species, but in this sense, within the idea of Imago Christi, we are the servant species. So the question becomes, how does a servant species inhabit and steward a shared earth? And it does so through attentive care, restraint, and compassion towards its fellow creatures. So for me, loving an animal doesn't mean collapsing the distinction between human and non-human relationships, but it does mean extending genuine moral concern, affection, and responsibility towards them as fellow creatures with their own, their own value in the eyes of God.
So what does that mean in terms of putting people or animals, as we say, out of their misery?
When I look at my relationship with Pacino, I want him to live a flourishing life. And if there is no way in which I can assist him in immediate pain, assist him with feeling comfortable through pain, I think the most humane thing is to euthanize. I don't think I would question that. I mean, it would be a very difficult decision, but in how that relates to humans, I don't know. I think I'm a bit nervous to talk about that on air today.
Something to reflect on in a quiet moment.
Yes.
And David, you think this is a precious time when an animal is sick or dying?
Absolutely. When any being is sick or dying, the Buddhist view is that the state of mind with which you die can be very important in determining what happens next. And so helping any being die with a state of peaceful mind, peaceful heart, is our main priority. We are all told that if you are with somebody who's dying who has, say, strong Christian beliefs, then you should encourage them to focus on those positive beliefs about what will happen to them next. If you're with an atheist, you should communicate in terms that are meaningful to them about maybe a wonderful life that they've had, the wonderful relationships they've had, whatever is going to be peaceful, peace-inducing.
Do you not sometimes think that, you know, if one of those paths is correct, the others must by definition be incorrect?
Well, no, we're only focusing on the mind of the person who's dying, and we are trying to put that mind at peace. As far as we know, I mean, the fact is nobody can prove what happens, otherwise we'd all subscribe to that view. So we can only make the best of unknowables. And we do believe that something continues, and the state of mind, the state of heart with which that being continues is all important in determining the immediate moments thereafter. So our objective is really to try and create the most peaceful state possible.
And David, you think this may not mean sending your animal to a cold, you know, stainless steel table in a vet's surgery to be euthanized?
Certainly if that can be avoided, yes. I think most pets dislike the vets. I've yet to have a pet that was enthusiastic when they walked through the doors.
It's like a dog dentist.
Exactly. So, you know, euthanasia is a sad fact that most of us will have to encounter at some point, and far better to do it in the most congenial way for your pet. Once again, we're keeping our pet's mind first and foremost in our thoughts. And so if somebody can come into the house and administer an injection, which for many pets is a fairly painless procedure which relaxes them, which they can do, and then that person normally withdraws for a while, we can say our goodbyes, we can chant our mantras, we can say our prayers, we can follow whatever observances we feel are helpful, and then only then the person can then administer the final dose. Well, that is a beautiful way for an animal to be able to die compared to the opposite.
Mm-hmm. And we know for sure that you mentioned mantras. We know for sure that meditation has positive effects on the mind. Science reveals this.
Yes.
What about the animal, non-human minds?
Well, that's a fascinating question. And I really do think it's just like human beings. Meditation is a wonderful practice for those who enjoy it. You can sit in a room with 100 people, and I often do meditation seminars, and you get lots of people come to them, and some of them clearly like a duck to water, and others normally dragged by their enthusiastic spouses, clearly not enjoying it. And the point is that some people really find meditation helpful and others don't. And I feel it's exactly the same with pets. I know from personal experience that some of the cats that I have had have been really, really enthusiastic, to the point that one of them used to interrupt my afternoon. If I was spending too much time on my computer, she'd walk between me and my screen as if to say, come, you know, you've been at this long enough. It's time for your afternoon session. Whereas other cats that I've had have been completely disinterested in meditation. And similarly with dogs. So I do feel that pets and human beings are similar in many respects, but including their capacity to get benefit from meditation.
Millie, what about kids and grieving the loss of an animal? We used to think the problem was kids don't have the cognitive capacity to understand death like adults. Or if we quickly gave them a new pet, it'd make things better. Is this too simplistic?
I think so. So developmentally, it's first off, it's going to depend on the age of the child and their ability to understand a more abstract concept such as death. So for example, if it's a really young child, they might think that their pet is sleeping somewhere and not at home, whereas an older child is going to be able to understand the finality of death, but might still have questions as to where that pet goes. A common grief reaction for children is they might have a delayed or latent response or reaction, meaning that they seem like they're fine in the face of losing a pet, but then it might take a week or two or more, and they start to really realize the weight of the loss and the reality of that loss. And so some of that responsibility is going to fall upon the parent or caregiver to be prepared to do some explaining and possibly repeating over and over again as a child continues to try and grasp what's happening.
So, Daniela, tell me about this grief process. It happens obviously in the context of a family, which has different dynamics.
Yeah, if you have multiple animals living at home, you know, when there is a loss of a pet, I can speak to an example, actually. My sister and I, we live only a couple of streets away, which is quite convenient for us and makes us very happy to drop in from time to time during the week. And usually I take Pacino with me and he goes and visits, I guess, his little kitty cousins, we call them. And my sister, she has three cats and two beautiful dogs. And Pacino, he happily enjoys their company. We've brought them up this way that they're able to enjoy each other's company and not feel lonely during the week. So unfortunately, my sister's very young kitten had a freak accident and she broke her back. It was such a traumatic time because we've never dealt with injury before, especially something as violent as this one. And my sister was doing so much. She spent a lot of money to give this kitten the best care and the best chance to live a full and flourishing life. Unfortunately, the injury was just too grave, really, because she hadn't fully developed as well. The way that she was growing, it was the injury was really stopping her growth. And so my sister had to make a very difficult decision to put Chi-Chi, her name was, to put Chi-Chi down. So I spoke to my sister and my sister was beside herself. And I said to her, listen, why don't we see if we can get the vet to come to the home and we'll have all of our animals gather together and see Chi-Chi off. And I think it was the most beautiful moment that we can reflect on in such a very dark, obviously a very dark situation. But Chi-Chi was surrounded by all of her non-human family and they were quietly you know how they can get a bit disruptive and very playful? They were all around her as if they were in mourning. They knew what the time had come. And so the vet gently put her down. And at that moment, one of Gabby's dogs started howling at the time that she was put down. And they all had their opportunity to say goodbye and to recognise that Chi-Chi was no longer with us. So thinking to that, I think, well, you know, are we giving our co-creatures the chance to grieve their own loss when a member of the family has died, whether the member is human or non-human? You know, so many of us, you know, we pass away in hospitals. When does the non-human allow, when are they allowed to have that closure? And so thinking through grief, that it is a shared experience, not limited to the human.
Does our culture, David, suggest we anthropomorphize pets by projecting a human emotion like grief onto them? Or is Daniela's story real to you?
Daniela's story is very real, very beautiful to me. And it is so clear to me that animals do sense grief. I mean, how many anecdotes do we need of dogs sitting on the graves of their loved masters, and so many tales of that kind, of also animals who've been separated from their family over the most extraordinary periods of distance and time, finding their way back. There's no question that there is an intense bond there. And yeah, this whole aspect of how much do animals think and feel, I feel is something we're only starting to really get to grips with now that we have sufficiently advanced technology to deal with it and the interest in it. And of course, the question then arises in my mind, and I'm sure everyone else listening to this has got to ask themselves, well, what is the difference between our cat and that lamb that we had for lunch on Sunday? You know, thinking, feeling beings. Why do we have such a capacity to open our hearts and our minds to some animals but not others? This is a real challenge.
What are the implications of this?
They're profound. I mean, from a Buddhist perspective, if we treat all animals as sentient beings, well, then we must respect their lives. We don't just use them as units of production. And I think this goes some way to explaining what Millie was talking about, disenfranchised grief, because it's almost like saying, well, it's just an animal. Why are you getting so upset about it? That is an attitude what one adopts if you believe that animals are merely a unit of production. They're just there for our bidding. However, if we reject that view, if we take them as sentient beings, just like us, mind possesses, then of course our view towards them is radically different.
But so radically different, the implications of what you say, it's almost like a bank that's too big to fail, you know, the model in which we live.
Exactly.
What do you reckon, Daniela?
Obviously, from a theological perspective, my theology on animals and that I care for animals has ethical implications, doesn't it? And so for me personally, making a decision to stop eating meat was something that, you know, I come from an Italian family. You know, to say that you're stopping to eat meat is not only a big cultural shock, but also when you've been brought up eating meat and then saying, okay, well, I think I feel differently to the non-human creature now. I think I need to reassess where I stand with that and how I steward God's good earth and what does that mean for me. So that has been a decision that I've had to make, especially when thinking that, gosh, I really have so much to say in the animal space and I can't say it by feeling like a hypocrite.
But do you still see yourself living the best expression of the wonderful Australian-Italian culture and the best expression of Christianity, even though, you know, you're Italian who's now turned away from the magic of lamb and a Christian who has a new idea about the primacy of the human?
I think because I have, theologically, it has resonated with me that to be an image of Christ is to live a non-violent life. When we think about people that are vegetarian or vegan, really they're just people that are sick of the violence, that they want to put a stop to violent infrastructure within our society, within our systems of power. So it is revolutionary in many ways because it says that I don't want to be a part of this violence. We're seeing so much abuse of power within our political systems, let alone our food systems. And so to say, listen, I don't want any part of that, it means doing something radical. And hey, as an Italian-Australian, that one of those radical moves is to step away from meat and to say, well, listen, I think I need to reevaluate my position. And at the end of the day, I'm really blessed because the Italian cuisine has some excellent vegetarian meals.
It does. So, I can vouch for that.
So you know, it's not too much to give up, but obviously, you know, cultural foregrounding, it does obviously impact a lot of our, you know, ethical decisions. It's what's always been done. So why do I need to do it differently? Why do I need to sacrifice? So for me personally, in order to live a self-sacrificial life like Christ, it means to make some decisions that avoid violence in various capacities.
And you can also say, as a great Mediterranean culture, meat was very much a delicacy, very rarely had. So, in fact, you could say you're living the truest of the Italian-Australian lives.
Yes.
But, James, I think that can be said generally across the board. Until a couple of centuries ago, most of us would have hardly eaten meat. So it's a very modern phenomenon, this meat eating. And also, Daniela used the phrase self-sacrificing in not eating meat. I'm sure the longer you, because I found this, you know, I was brought up as a steak-eating Rhodesian. It was almost a patriotic duty to eat it. But now I don't feel in any way that I'm missing out by not eating meat. And the horror show that you rightly say is happening just outside our major cities. All the abattoirs are always kept away from prying eyes. But I think if anyone spent any time at all in those facilities, they would stop eating meat immediately. So I do feel that, you know, it's really people stick their heads in the sand and they don't want to know. And that's fine, but it's not really dealing with the truth.
David, that's how animals leave the world. What about coming into it? Did animals come into our lives for a purpose?
I wouldn't use the word purpose, but I would certainly invoke the term karma, which is karma is this connection that we form with beings over lifetimes. And a Buddhist perspective is that no two beings come into contact, especially close contact, completely by chance. So the fact that there is a being, living under the same roof as a number of other beings, whether they're human or other, is not something that happens coincidentally. It's because of some previous attraction or maybe non-attraction, but there's some relationship that's already established that was powerful enough for that being to be propelled into your life, which raises all kinds of fascinating questions. Yeah, that's another reason why we should be very, very careful with the beings who come into our lives, whether they're human or animal, in the sense that where do they come from? Was this person, you know, a mother in my previous relationship? Was in my previous lifetime? Was it a sister? What kind of relationship might I have had with them? And when we start to regard animals as, and we start to see all life forms in that way, it really makes life far more vivid, interesting, and delightful.
Millie Cordaro, when you hear this, do you have your professor's hat on or your pet owner's hat on?
Funny that you ask that question. It is ironic and such a meaningful coincidence because I'm a vegetarian. And I became a vegetarian, I was either 15 or 16 years old when I could finally control what I was eating. And there was a couple years leading up to that where I just kept thinking that I just didn't want to eat meat. And part of that coincidence is with Daniela. So my ancestry is also Italian. And so for me, when I was trying to proclaim this new vegetarianism, my Italian uncle would make lamb lasagna, you know, instead of sausage lasagna, thinking that, well, that's not meat. And so I come from a perspective where I knew that I didn't want to eat meat, and I was so young that I couldn't quite put my thumb as to why, but it felt like something that was just very meaningful for me that I wasn't aware of yet and really able to articulate yet. And that was 30 plus years ago, and I feel really good about the relationship that I have with all animals, with the land, in terms of doing my part and being as harmonious as I can with them.
And Daniela, do you think animals come into our life for a purpose?
I think everybody comes into our life for a purpose, whether human or non-human. I think for me personally, it's to exercise in the fruits of the spirit. How can I love this human or non-human? How can I experience joy with this human or non-human? Peace and patience and kindness and goodness and faithfulness and gentleness and self-control. When I think through that lens, I think about, well, it's not about not only how I'm treating my co-creature or, you know, fellow human, but it's also what is reciprocated relationally. And I think that's why pets are so important. You know, companion animals are so important because they share in an intimacy with us where we are constantly exercising a relationality with them. You know, they may probe our door to the bathroom even in our most intimate moments because they want us to come out. They want to see our faces. They may sleep on our beds because they want to be with us. And I think when they come into our lives, if you're blessed enough to have a non-human creature enter your life, it is really a demonstration on how, especially from a Christian perspective, how can I exercise patience with them, faithfulness? How can I be truly faithful to their flourishing? Does it mean that I do prioritize them within my household, or are they left outside in the rain and they just have to deal with it because they're just a smelly dog who gets an occasional pat sometimes? Or are they very much ingrained into my family because there is a deliberate relationality that is being built?
Sounds like you've got some lucky pets, Daniela. That brings us to the end of what's been a nourishing and a warm show, even though it's been about the grief we suffer when we lose our pets. A warm thank you to all our guests for making it what it is. Millie in Austin, Texas, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And in our Brisbane studios, Daniela, thank you.
Thank you.
And in Perth, thank you, David.
Thank you, James.
Millie Cordaro is Professor of Psychology at Texas State University. Many research papers to her name in psychology journals, including about pet grief. Dr. Daniela Rizzo, a theologian at Alpha Crucis University College. Your new book is, what, out in a month or two?
Yeah, a couple of months. I think it's in production.
Animal Pneumatology, which is about what we've been talking about, the spirituality and indeed the spirit in animals. Mm. And David Mikey, known around the world for his many novels and his non-fiction books about Buddhism and animals. David, are the titles your wonderful idea or your publisher's?
No, I do enjoy coming up with a snappy title. So Buddhism for Pet Lovers is probably the most relevant title for this discussion.
That's Buddhism for Pet Lovers may be the most relevant, but it's not the catchiest. I love not the power of now, but the power of meow. Awaken the kitten within, that's a favorite. The art of purring, that's a real page turner.
Well, obviously what I was doing is just playing on the tropes that are known in the self-help and in a development field, feline-friendly versions.
Yes, and both getting through our restrictive copyright laws and revealing that the cats in your house are very, very lucky indeed.
Well, I'm not sure that they would think so.
Oh, well, cats are like that, so ungrateful. But I'm grateful. We'll put a link also to the wonderful episode of Compass, Goodbye, My Dog. This is the episode where Indira Naidoo visited three families as they spent their last precious days with old dogs. Look, you can email me at godforbid@abc.net.au. Our website will have links and guest details. Thanks to producer Amanda Roberts. I'm James Carlton. Until next week, remember to be good. This has been God Forbid.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.